Greetings and stagmontic retribulations, my myofragmaric listeners, and welcome to this August 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this pathetically puerile podcast segment, Jim Campanella. So if everything works out right, this will be the second science update that you're going to hear in August. Yahoo! Okay, so still no idiot scientist of the month for August. I guess that's a good thing, right? However, this evening I'll start out talking about a couple of bits of science news that I came across while in San Jose, California, at the beginning of this month for the 2019 Conference of the American Society for Plant Biologists. There were a few good talks, but I will honestly say I had trouble keeping awake through many of the scientific symposia that were presented, in part because some of the material was just so bloody, insidiously boring that you could use those segments to put chronic insomniacs unconscious. But the other reason I had such difficulty with many talks is a malady that I have suffered since I was a college student. And that malady is that I have a great deal of difficulty understanding heavy accents, especially Asian accents. I don't know whether this is because of a brain misalignment, or a neural shortcoming, or what. But my brain translates much of those heavy accents as pure gibberish. I mean, the issue played havoc with some of my classes taught by those whose first language was not English. It is still a bane. I mean, I have students with heavy accents, and I have difficulty understanding them sometimes. I have them repeat a question two or three times, and I feel very embarrassed about that. Anyway, my brain just drifted through many talks by researchers from China. However, there were several topics that did keep my attention. And the first was presented by Dr. Rishi Massalia. He was the chair of the symposia, which he entitled, Plants You Can Drink, Eat, or Smoke. Now, Rishi was a hoot, to say the least. He was the most laid-back speaker I have ever seen at one of these meetings. He's a large, dark Indian fellow in his early 30s with long, curly black hair, and he sounds like he's channeling director, actor, podcaster Kevin Smith most of the time. To put it very simply, Dr. Rishi was very mellow. Dr. Rishi works for a company called LeafWorks. More on them in a second. He's the company's director of bioinformatics, which is actually quite key to what the company does. Now, Rishi's talk was much more laid back than his conference abstract would lead you to believe. It went like this, quote, "With public opinion quickly changing, more states are legalizing cannabis, enabling the scientific community to investigate this plant, allowing us to pose basic biological questions about genetic diversity and ancestry. To explore the current breadth of genetic diversity in cannabis and how that relates to naming conventions, we present analyses of genome-wide SNP data from a large collection of cannabis accessions. Our results indicate discrepancies in cannabis labeling and genetic clustering based on classic cannabis idiotypes, that is, indica and sativa," unquote. Basically, what Rishi's company LeafWorks does out in the Great West of California, Oregon, and Washington, where cannabis is legalized, is to do genetic testing in marijuana pharmacies, growers, and manufacturers to ensure that the particular brand of marijuana that you get is what you are buying and or have been prescribed for. And apparently this is a serious issue because especially at pharmacies, dispensaries, whatever they call them, you have a 60% chance of not getting the particular cultivar or strain that you requested. And that value is based on a study done by Rishi and LeafWorks. Rishi says that, especially at pharmacies, that if a popular cultivar gets sold out, the clerk there will simply refill the empty jar with something else to continue to sell it. I didn't realize that all the cultivars have different amounts of THC and apparently very different profiles that have very different effects. They can act as stimulants or depressives or cause varying levels of hallucinogenic highs or even have pain-killing abilities. This may not be quite so important for your casual user, but if you get a prescription from a doctor specifically with some strain that has a particular palliative effect, and it does not have any therapeutic effects at all, that may be because your sour diesel was replaced by purple Kush Man, as Rishi so elegantly put it. The company is putting together a standard of strains to do genetic testing against so that the growers, the pharmacies, and the buyers will all know what they are getting and be confident of the particular kind of high they will experience. LeafWorks apparently does do genetic testing on other expensive herbal cash crops as well, but their big money crop seems to be cannabis. Another interesting talk was given by Dr. Celeste Holz-Steitiger, Director of Research at Impossible Foods. For those of you not familiar with Impossible Foods, they are a company which in the last 2 years have made incredible progress in making vegetable-based protein that tastes like meat. Their main product is the Impossible Burger. I've tasted this, and let me tell you that it's pretty much amazing. I mean, the taste is beefy and the texture is absolutely perfect. You can still tell that it's not quite beef, but it is the closest thing to real meat made now, with no animal proteins at all, that I have ever eaten. Obviously, Impossible Foods wants to make money as a company. That's the goal of every company. But beyond that, they're trying to help this world as it slips deeper and deeper into decline. Humans have the desire to eat meat, and the demand is only rising, and doing things like destroying the Amazon rainforest is not helping anything. Unfortunately, due to dramatically high greenhouse gas emissions, water consumptions, and land utilizations, animal agriculture is now one of the most environmentally destructive industries on the planet. Impossible Foods thinks that they have the solution to motivate consumers to reduce their consumption of animal-based products. They have created the sensory experience that meat eaters demand, and they have studied meat at the molecular level to identify the biochemical principles underlying the unique flavor and textural attributes of meat. They searched the plant kingdom for materials to recreate those specific properties. One of their discoveries was that heme, the iron-containing cofactor in hemoglobin and myoglobin, is chiefly responsible for the flavor of meat, of beef more specifically. The bloody metallic flavor of beef in its raw state is from heme. Also, when cooked, heme generates beefy flavors and aromas that are critical to the sensory experience of beef. Heme is ubiquitous in nature in most organisms, and Impossible Foods found heme proteins in plants that are capable of the same flavor characteristics. One example of this is leg hemoglobin, found in the root nodules of soybeans. They combine this soybean heme protein with simple nutrients, plant proteins, and fats to assemble a plant-based burger that has all the sensory and cooking experiences of beef. Their newly identified plant-based flavor system enables the creation of meat products that carnivores crave with a fraction of the environmental impact. They have a noble goal to feed our growing human population while expanding forested lands, increasing fresh water, and decreasing greenhouse gases. They announced at the conference that as of August 16, 2019, Burger King in the U.S. would start serving Impossible Whoppers. So at least here in the States, many of you will finally be able to taste this amazing stuff. Additionally, Dr. Celeste told us that by the end of 2019, packages of Impossible Burger meat would start being sold at regular grocery stores. I suspect more healthy places like Whole Foods will likely carry it than your local Piggly Wiggly down the street, though. Okay, how about a couple of regular stories here? So for years, whenever I have talked about human genetic treatment for diseases, I have told my classes that it's a very long way off. We can treat some genetic diseases of the blood, for example, But any disease that needs a new gene to be expressed deep in the tissues, or a gene turned off for that matter, like the brain, have been absolutely impossible. The problem has been a delivery system. Yes, we can make lovely new functioning genes to replace the non-functioning ones, but how do you get the genes into tissues with billions and billions of cells and get them all to express this new improved gene? For a long time, it was thought that putting genes into retroviruses might be the key to transport. Retroviruses have the ability to take DNA and transfer it from cell to cell and put it into the nucleus, but that was a bust. In short, to date, technology has not been able to provide a safe, efficacious way to replace, inactivate, or introduce new genes for clinical applications. Well, it looks like that problem may have been finally solved. Recently, a collaboration between the Chinese Academy of Sciences and Tufts University has provided novel insights into the next generation of gene therapy technology. The main author of the study was Dr. Xiaoping Zhu of Tufts, and the work was published in the journal Advanced Materials in last month's issue. Zhu says, quote, "There are many diseases that have been long intractable for which CRISPR therapies could offer new hope. For example, sickle cell anemia, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, Huntington's disease, and even many cancers," unquote. We've talked in the past about what the CRISPR-Cas9 system is. Remember, it's a powerful gene editing system that has been available for the last few years and has grown massively in use and popularity. Unfortunately, due to the large size and low permeability of the molecules involved, targeted entry into a cell and nucleus has been challenging. To overcome this, Zhu's research team identified a synthetic biodegradable lipid, a fat, that's reported to safely encapsulate the Cas9 messenger RNA and a guide RNA. This lipid acts as a nanocarrier to deliver the contents directly into target cells, and then it contains disulfide bonds that break upon cell entry, allowing simultaneous release of the contents into the cell where the Cas9 protein is translated from the mRNA. The protein can then anneal up, it can attach to the guide RNA for efficient trafficking into the nucleus. Zhu states, quote, "The lipid nanoparticles are one of the most efficient CRISPR-Cas9 carriers that we have ever seen," unquote. To determine whether this novel lipid could work in clinical medicine, the researchers aim to diminish the function of the PCSK9 gene in mice. This gene, when inhibited, has been shown to reduce low-density lipoprotein, LDL, resulting in a decreased risk of cardiovascular disease. They were able to knock down PCSK9 expression in mice to 80% of their usual expression in the liver, suggesting a real promise for therapeutic applications. Moreover, they reported an in vitro study that they did with a 70% reduction in HeLa cell line viability. Remember, HeLa cells are cancer cells, where they targeted an oncogene called HPV18 to be knocked down. Zhu concluded, quote, "We are just starting to see human clinical trials for CRISPR therapies. Our hope is that this advance will take us another step toward making CRISPR an effective and practical approach to medical treatment," unquote. Next story, scientific sign language. According to this story from Genetic Engineering News, the scientific world will be made a bit easier for the hearing impaired now. Why? Imagine that you're deaf and you have to spell out complicated words like deoxyribonucleotide in sign language to communicate with other scientists. It would be a seriously annoying issue. That's why a determined young university student should be praised for inventing brand new ways for deaf scientists to communicate. Liam McMulkin, who was born deaf, was the first person in his family to pursue a higher education after he enrolled at the University of Dundee to study life sciences in 2015. Like most first-year students, McMulkin had already been anxious about being able to keep up a college workload. Since he was also the only deaf student at the university, he also feared he would have trouble keeping up with the course lectures. Though there are some British Sign Language translations for scientific vocabulary words, the lexicon becomes fairly limited for college-level communication. As McMulkin continued studying in university, he became more and more frustrated by how his translator would be forced to spell out long, complex words. McMulkin told the BBC, quote, "Watching the interpreters for a one-hour lecture was very tiring. There were lots of new words and scientific words that were often very long, like deoxyribonucleotide and deoxyribonucleoside. Sometimes the interpreter would be fingerspelling for ages, and I was having to watch that. We would make up new signs, which meant it was easier next time, but it also meant I had to continually learn new signs, which was very tiring." Unquote. McMulkin finally resolved to develop a whole new set of BSL vocabulary words for himself and future life science students. To date, he has created over 100 new signs for scientific words that have been officially recognized in the formal BSL, which is used by approximately 87,000 people across the UK. Now, I have enough trouble understanding accents. I can't even imagine having to fingerspell highly technical terms while sitting in a lecture or having a quick conversation with a colleague. That would be pretty taxing and pretty difficult. I guess Liam is starting to study for his master's degree this September, and that he wants to eventually become a researcher. I'm sure he will be excited to see his new words ease the struggles of other deaf scientists who are following in his footsteps. Next story. Astronomers have spotted a new kind of planet, a Neptune-sized world sitting scorchingly close to its star. It could be in the midst of transforming from a hot, puffy gas giant to a naked, rocky core. Astronomer Dr. James Jenkins of the University of Santiago reported on this new phenomenon July 29th at the TESS Science Conference at MIT. The planet, called LTT-9779b, orbits a sun-like star about 260 light-years away from Earth here. It was discovered by NASA's Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, TESS, which launched in April 2018. Data collected by TESS shows that the planet swings around its star once every 19 hours, putting it in a rare class of planets that orbit incredibly close to their stars. Jenkins says, quote, "Most other planets with such close orbits are either Earth-sized or Jupiter-sized and larger, but LTT-9779b is 4.6 times Earth's size and 29 times Earth's mass, placing it right in the middle of those extremes. Its proximity to its star should heat up to about 2,000 Kelvin, which is about 1,725 degrees Celsius, making it the first known ultra-hot Neptune," unquote. One explanation that's suggested for how close-in planets get cozy with their stars is that the worlds form farther away and then migrate closer over time. A planet that had a thick gaseous atmosphere might lose more and more of that gas the closer it comes to its star, as the heat evaporates the atmosphere or the star's gravity steals the gas away. At about 2.5 million kilometers from its star, LTT-9779b may be about the closest a planet can physically get before the star gobbles up all of its atmosphere. If so, it could be a bridge between exoplanets that astronomers have been calling hot Jupiters, which are gas giants like Jupiter but have a much closer orbit, and smaller, scorched, rocky worlds. Jenkins continued with, quote, "The new planet is much smaller than a hot Jupiter, but it still has a thick atmosphere that makes up about 9% of its mass," unquote. The next step is to measure how quickly LTT-9779b is losing mass. If it's rapid, that could explain why no other ultra-hot Neptunes have been discovered yet. They shift from gas giant to rocky core too quickly. Jenkins says that finding one in mid-transition may have been a stroke of luck. All right, for the last story of the evening, let's stick to astronomy. So astronomers may have finally laid eyes on a population of enormous but elusive galaxies from the early universe. These hefty star-forming galaxies are shrouded in dust, which hid them from previous searches that used starlight. Now observations of the radiation emitted by that interstellar dust has revealed dozens of massive active galaxies from when the universe was younger than 2 billion years old. This was reported by researchers online August 7th in the journal Nature. The main author on the paper was Dr. Dao Wang, an astronomer at the University of Tokyo. These galaxies may be the long-sought precursors to heavyweight galaxies seen later in the universe's history, as well as the most massive galaxies around today. The paper says that big, inactive galaxies have been found dating back to a couple billion years after the Big Bang. But the formation of those gentle giants has remained mysterious. That's because astronomers expect such massive, inactive galaxies to originate from big star-forming powerhouses, and surveys of the earliest cosmos hadn't uncovered a population of such star-forming progenitor galaxies previously. Using the Atacama Large Millimeter/Submillimeter Array, ALMA, in Chile, to examine distant galactic dust emissions, Wang's group identified 39 star-forming galaxies from when the universe was about 1 billion to 2 billion years old. These galaxies, which boast an average mass of about 40 billion suns and form about 200 new suns per year, are about as common as the large inactive galaxies seen later in cosmic history. The newly identified galaxies are also embedded in that early era's most massive dark matter halos, blobs of invisible, unidentified particles that surround galaxies. The findings suggest that those ancient galaxies are the ancestors of today's biggest galaxies, which now sit in the most massive dark matter halos. These modern descendants may include behemoths like M87, home to the first black hole ever imaged. Wang says, quote, "The discovery of such big star-forming galaxies when the universe was less than 2 billion years old fits well with past observations of big quiescent galaxies later in cosmic history. But these observations don't jibe with current theories of galaxy formation. In computer simulations, the universe at 2 billion years old contains too few massive galaxies to explain our observations. This seems to be a surprise that the universe held for us." Unquote. Wang and colleagues now plan to take a larger census of ancient massive galaxies using the ALMA system. That work could give theorists more information about how to tweak cosmological simulations to match early universe observations. Well, that's all for me for now. Try an Impossible Burger. Be careful and make sure that you're not getting purple Urkel when you think you're buying Pineapple Express. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.